It's have us.
Have you missed that opening, Ellen?
Yeah, I do. I miss dancing to it.
Do, do, do. Do, 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 do.
That's the Skype call. That's the Skype voice. That's not happening.
That's just what I associate with doing this now.
Me
That's
too, so but we do dance to both in a Conan O'Brien fashion.
That's from The Simpsons.
Only I may dance.
Only. Hi, everybody. Welcome back to Murder in the Land of Oz. My name is Jess.
And my name is Ellen.
We haven't done that for a while. I just thought we would reintroduce so people knew who we were.
Yes.
Welcome to our almost 8,000 subscribers.
I know. There's so many people.
What? My friend, our friend, Matt Siri, put it into perspective for us by saying a few weeks ago when we hit 6,000, like, that's 3 Lyric Theatres, which is a massive theatre in Brisbane, filled with people listening to this podcast, which is terrifying.
It causes me great anxiety.
Definitely. Thank you all so much for your response to our Tasmanian season. We had such a fun time looking at the cases down there to Ellen's home turf.
Home turf.
Home turf.
Temporary home turf. Recent home turf.
For now. And now we are on to our first episode of our South Australian season.
Yay. We have literally been looking forward to South Australia since we started the podcast.
Because guess what?
So much fucking weird shit happens down in South Australia. All the good, like, crimes that just make you go, huh?
Why?
I feel like I read this, I think it's Salman Rushdie said that Adelaide was like a town from a Stephen King novel.
Yeah.
Which I feel like is just, you just go, and I mean, I've never been there, but my impression of Adelaide is that it's like essentially the upside down.
It's very boring.
Oh, really?
There's really not much to do.
Oh, well,
there's churches.
I was literally just about to say, really maybe pretty. I'll move to,
it's
maybe
really, really pretty. But like when I've been there in the past, we've been like, so what do we do?
So we hate everybody from Sydney, Melbourne, and Adelaide is boring.
No, I don't hate people in Adelaide.
Okay. I don't really know anybody from South Australia.
I still hate Sydney, by the way. I really hate Sydney.
I am scared of everybody who got mad at us for saying we hate Sydney, so I'm
You're
reassessing
retreating?
My opinion. Yeah.
Well, so not housekeeping, but housekeeping. We got to let you know that we do have a Patreon that you can subscribe to. We do have Patreon-only content.
We got to do a shout-out.
Oh, yeah, shout-out to our new subscriber.
Patreon.
Who is our new Patreon?
Jacob.
Oh my God, Jacob. That's right.
Jacob is our personal friend and he also recently became a Patreon.
Oh, bless him.
Bless his little cotton socks. Thanks, Jacob.
Love ya. So you can subscribe to be a Patreon. We will give you a shout out when I remember. I thought there was somebody after Jacob, so I remember Jacob, but we haven't recorded in so long.
No, we haven't. It's been like a month.
Cool. We also have TeePublic t-shirts. We have new ones with some of our like slogans, I guess.
Everything that Jess has been like, that would be a great quote for a t-shirt, is now a t-shirt.
Yeah. Botany Solves Crime. Speaking of, we Yeah, I completely forgot about this. So we had someone reach out to us via the Instagram, and her name is Jess, and her Instagram handle is The Green Thumb, and she was telling us that she worked with Dr. Gordon Geimer, who basically, I'm going to say, like, helped solve the murder of Alison Baden Clay.
Yeah, for sure.
With his botany work, he basically discovered, like, the 6 species in Alison's hair that basically determined that she was killed at home. And Jess actually, not me Jess, but this other Jess, works with Dr. Gordon Geimer and played him the podcast episode. And now around the herbarium, they call him the badass botanist. So we've organized some t-shirts for them that say Botany Solves Crime. So I will be hopefully handing them over to Jess and to Dr. Gordon Geimer soon, which is so exciting.
For
He's
sure, the best thing that has
guy.
Happened.
And he, like, was laughing at the episode and was very sweet and actually gave Jess his copy of the amazing book that we both read about Alison Baden Clay as well by David Murray. So, yes. How exciting.
Seriously, guys, the most exciting Rich thing that has ever happened in my life.
It's so cool. I so screamed.
Cool. Oh, yeah.
We do also have some Mitlu. We have a Mitlu event coming up later in the year. When we've got more details, we will let you know. But it would be a chance for you to come and meet Ellen and I, or it might just be me, or it might just be Ellen. I don't know. So we will let you know.
Could just be
that.
Two cardboard cutouts. It could. Like a little microphone through them.
It could be Zane holding up two photos.
It should be Zane.
I know, right? Everyone needs to meet Zane. Okay, well, let's get crack-a-lackin'. Yuck, that word's back. On,
no, it's not.
No, it's not. No, it's not. On our first Mitlu episode of the South Australian season, it's my turn to open Yay. This time. And I am going to be looking at the Truro murders.
Now, I know nothing about this, so I'm so excited.
Neither did I. And we did have a suggestion. I will find actually, I'll get Zane to look it up when we put the shout out for what cases to do in South Australia. Someone recommended us doing the Truro murder. So we'll get Zane to look while we are recording, and then we'll shout that person out at the end. All right. So let's get started.
That person's like, it was Pete. It was me.
We will say your name. I promise. Okay. So, late December 1976, 18-year-old Veronica Knight is shopping before going to Melbourne for the Christmas holiday. She had had a really troubled upbringing in her life. It was quite tumultuous because of difficulties at home, and she was really looking forward to her holiday. Her father was an alcoholic, and her mother had died shortly after her birth. She was removed from the care of her father because he was too unstable to care for her, so she grew up in foster/Salvation Army homes. She was held back in her education as well because of her rough childhood. So Veronica had been shopping with a friend and had been separated, and then she was never seen alive again. She was reported missing after 24 hours, but because of her desires of going to Melbourne, it was thought that she had hitchhiked. So the missing person report got shelved and people basically stopped looking for her.
She hitchhiked when she was going shopping with a friend?
Yeah.
She was just like, yo, I'm bailing. I'm going to just go. Okay, that makes sense.
That sounds like something I would do.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't sound like anything that any human being would ever do.
No. Okay, so 10 days later, on the 2nd of January 1977, 15-year-old Tanya Kenny was staying with her friends after Christmas in Adelaide. When Tanya failed to return that night to her parents' house, they thought that she was basically staying over with a friend. But after her not showing up for the next day, they began to worry and they contacted the police. And she was never seen alive again. With the two, there were two disappearances, but the police basically struggled to find a connection between the two girls. So then, 21st of January 1977, 16-year-old Juliet Makita is waiting for a bus after finishing work at her part-time job. She rang her parents to let them know that she was going to be home late. When Juliet's father woke up the next morning and Juliet wasn't home, he said in this interview that he was furious. And because, you know, it was extremely out of character and he was just, you know, disappointed. So at midday, Juliet's dad rang all of her friends and all of the Adelaide hospitals in order basically to track her down, and he couldn't. So he turned to the police, and the police said to him, if I had a dollar for every worried parent whose child had gone out and had eventually come home, I would be a rich man. So they didn't end up taking the Makitas seriously at all.
Oh, God.
6th of February 1977, 16-year-old Sylvia Pittman was waiting for a train at the Adelaide Railway Station. She basically was never seen. Sylvia's family reported her missing. They went to huge extents to find her. The 7th of February, 26-year-old Vicky Howell was waiting outside the Adelaide post office. She'd been in an unhappy marriage and had quite a troubled life, and she was never seen again. She was never seen alive again, I should say. 2 days later, on the 9th of January 1977, they call her Connie Jordan, but she did have a previous name. But 9th of January 1977, Connie Jordan was in the city centre of Adelaide, and that was her last known whereabouts. 3 days later, 20-year-old Deborah Lamb was hitchhiking on West Terrace, and that's been known as her last whereabouts. So that is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. So that's 7 women reported missing in a real...
What was the time frame?
So the last disappearance was the 7th of February. The first one was on, come on, Word document. The first one was end of December, right?
So like 3 months, basically. Yep. Oof. Oof. Nothing to see here, though,
no,
folks.
Nothing
just
to worry
team
about.
Just team runaways.
No worries.
Just going to go hitchhike to Melbourne real quick.
So
you wait here in front of Supray. I'm just going to hitchhike to Melbourne.
I'm just going to hitchhike to Melbourne real quick. So then it stopped. After 2 months of women disappearing, it just all stopped. So for months on end, the parents of these missing girls lived in hope that their beloved daughters would come home or get in contact with them. Mick Makita, whose daughter Juliet had been missing, actually thought he had – he told this – it was so sad. He was basically driving down a street. He saw this group of girls and he thought he saw Juliet, and he literally got out of the car and started running and then realized that it wasn't her. And he was like, I mean, thank God, like, I didn't like grab her or something like that, because how crazy would have I looked?
Oh, but that's so heartbreaking.
It's so sad. And I know you've spoken a bit about like how important it is to get publicity for people that are missing, because there's always people that are looking, you know, there's always people, mm-hmm. there's always someone looking for this person and wondering if they're okay. So it's just mm-hmm. crazy that even still now, like when people get reported missing, sometimes it's not taken, if it's not taken seriously by the public, then people are like, oh, she's just gone and, you know, nah.
Yeah, especially back in the day, you know, when you kind of had to try a lot harder to get a message out there about somebody going missing, because obviously there was no internet or anything like that. Now we can share photos of missing people around the globe in seconds, but, you know, especially if somebody goes missing, getting at least an international or a national photo, like in a national newspaper or something like that, within a relatively short time of the person going missing, can be like make or break for ever finding them.
Exactly. So we're going to jump forward to the 25th of April, 1978. Bill and Valda Thomas found what they thought was the remains of an animal while they were mushrooming in the bushland outside of a small town called Truro. So Truro is about...
It's never an animal.
It's never an animal. And it's never a mannequin either.
No.
Truro is...
It's never anything good.
Truro is 80 kilometres southwest of Adelaide. The 2011 census, it was counted that the population of Truro was a mere 395 people, so you could imagine how few people there would have been back in 1978. So Bill and Valda basically find bones, but they think it's just like a kangaroo or something, so they go home. And in the interview on Crime Investigation Australia that I watched, basically their son was like, look, mum like had like a really restless night and she just had a feeling that something wasn't right and that they should go back. So she told her husband to return. And then they basically just to like just to put her at ease that the, you know, the remains were of an animal. And basically from where they were to where they'd found the remains, that was about an hour drive. Mm-hmm. So they went back to have a look at the remains, and upon closer inspection, they found a shoe nearby and the remains of a foot inside the shoe.
Oh, no. Kangaroos don't wear shoes.
No, they do not. They also find clothing and a skull nearby. So the police converge on the scene and they confirm that the remains are of a teenage girl. But due to the state of the remains, because it was out in the elements, people, the police are unsure of like what the cause of death was and even how long that she'd been out there. The terrain is quite harsh, so it could easily have been a situation that this person had basically come off the road, like they'd gotten out of a car or something and gone walking and gotten disorientated and died of thirst because there's really nothing anywhere
around.
Yeah. And then the dental records of the remains confirmed that the remains are that of Veronica Knight, who was the first victim, who's the first girl that we talked about who went missing. So the discovery of Veronica's remains basically get little to no public attention. Over the preceding year, the number of girls that are reported missing in the Adelaide area decreases, but there's still like no way to connect. Well, the police don't think there's a way of connecting the disappearances of all the girls. And then Detective Ken Thorson received a report from an officer within his division who believed that they had found a connection between the disappearances and that a pattern had started to emerge. with the new information, the police appeal to all of the families of the missing girls and the people that come forward to go public once again with the disappearance of their daughters is the Makita family. So they went on TV, they went on radio, they went on a lot of public publications, they went on newspapers, they went on Women's Days, Women Weeklies, basically just being like, if you know anything about what has happened to our daughter or to any of the girls that are missing from the Adelaide area, like, please come forward. But once again, no new information gets put forward. So the trail goes cold once again. So then almost a year later, on the 15th of April 1979, bushwalkers come across some more remains, which were only 1 kilometre away from where Veronica Knight had been found. The difference between the two discoveries is that Veronica Knight was basically, she was found 100 metres away from Swamp Road. Now, the remains that they had found were that of Sylvia Pittman's. So her body was actually quite a far bit more inland, so it wasn't as easy from, it wasn't a lot of easy access from the road. So the person, or however Sylvia's body got there, they would have been driven quite far in inland.
Yeah, it wasn't like they could just, like, come up from the road.
So with another body being discovered, it seemed obvious to the police to further investigate the bushland outside of Truro at the prospect of finding more victims. So it wasn't long before more remains were found. A skull was found on the opposite side of Swap Road. A fourth body had been found, so police believed that they'd found the dump site of a serial killer, basically. And this is when the media descended, and, like, the footage, I've linked in, I've gotten Ellen to link in the show notes this video of Crime Investigation Australia, which I all recommend you watching. But this was before, like, the news had to be careful about what they showed and, like, how close that they could get on crime scenes and stuff like that. So you can, I will just warn you that you do see bones getting pulled up by policemen. It is quite real. Also, the fashion choices of the police are quite real as well. But the, yeah, it's quite confronting having to look at basically them digging up remains because they didn't obviously have cordoned off areas back then, which is pretty wild.
Yeah, couldn't put up one of them tents.
Yeah, no, definitely not.
One of those blue tents.
So the third and the fourth victims were found in quite an advanced state of decomp. So police were relying on dental records, as they did back then, to identify the remains of the victims. So the third and fourth victims were that of Connie Jordan and Vicky Howell. So the remains were all found partially buried. And weeks go by and, you know, the investigation starts to stall. So then the police start to, like, piece together a rough timeline, but they're puzzled as to, like, why the murders had just stopped.
It's just stopped.
So, and then they also found, like, there was evidence of quite a bit of escalation. So, like, as you heard in the timeline that I read out, like, there was and then there was quite a sporadic number of disappearances, and then once again stops. So among the thousands of leads that police had begun to look at, they started to look at the death of former prison inmate Christopher Worrell. Now, Worrell fitted the profile of a violent sex offender and was actually killed in a car accident around the time that the murders had stopped. Police appealed to the public, and a few weeks later, a member of the public came forward saying that they knew the identity of the person responsible for the bodies at Truro. So someone had heard from someone else that someone had been raping and killing girls and then dumping them out near Truro. And the information was traced back to a man called James Miller, who had told this to Christopher Worrell's girlfriend at his funeral. Yep.
Oh, Lord. Just a casual, my condolences, by the way.
So from the information that the woman gave, it pointed to James Miller and to Christopher Worrell. So Miller and Worrell met when they were in prison together. Miller had been arrested for breaking and entering, Worrell for rape and breaching a 2-year suspended sentence for armed robbery. After release, they formed a dominant/submissive relationship and both lived and worked together. James Miller was infatuated with Christopher Worrell and would allow Miller to perform and Worrell would actually allow Miller to perform sexual acts on him while he read pornographically predominantly BDSM magazines.
Oh, I don't like that.
Worrell preferred women, so this relationship sort of ceased and they became sort of like a creepy brotherhood thing.
No, they didn't. No. You don't, you're not like, and now we're like brothers.
So an undercover police surveillance team tracked down James Miller and he was arrested and brought into the Adelaide police station. Following Christopher Worrell's death, Miller had suffered quite a depression and had become homeless. He was adamant that he had nothing to do with the murders, and then it slowly he began to divulge the deep, dark secrets of the Truro murders. So, back to the top. Veronica Knight. So Knight had become, as I said, separated from her friend while shopping and accepted a ride home from James Miller and Christopher Worrell. James Miller claimed that they talked her into going for a drive into the Adelaide foothills. Worrell parked while Miller went for a walk. Returning to the car, he found Knight dead. Miller alleged that he angrily confronted Christopher Worrell, who pulled a knife and threatened him. Worrell was in a black mood and wouldn't talk. Miller helped him dump the body at Truro, and then they both returned to work the next morning. 2nd of January, Tanya Kenny. Miller and Worrell picked up Tanya after she had just arrived in the city after hitchhiking from Victor Harbour. They drove to Miller's sister's home, and Miller and James Miller sat in the car while Christopher Worrell and Tanya went inside. Worrell later returned and asked for help, alleging an argument had occurred and Worrell had threatened to kill Miller if he didn't help. That night, they buried Tanya Kenny at Wingfield in Adelaide. So Juliet Makeda was waiting at a bus stop after finishing work, as I said. Christopher Worrell had offered her a lift home and instead they had driven her to Port Wakefield. This time, James Miller sat in the car while Christopher Worrell tied her up. This behaviour was not unusual as it was Christopher Worrell's kink. So James Miller thought nothing of it. James Miller alleged that he then went to take a walk but turned around after hearing a disturbance. Juliet was out of the car and falling to the ground. Christopher Worrell turned her over and began strangling her. James Miller claimed that he tried to pull Christopher Worrell off but he wasn't strong enough and that again Worrell threatened to kill him. So Juliet's remains were buried at Truro. So Christopher Worrell and James Miller then picked up Sylvia Pittman as she was waiting for the train. They drove her to the Wingfield area where James Miller once again claimed that he went for a walk and then came back to help dispose of the body. When James Miller arrived at the post office on the 7th of January 1977, Vicky Howell was already with Christopher Worrell. Miller went for a walk once again soon after returning and finding nothing untoward. He then took a longer walk. When he returned, Vicky was dead and Christopher Worrell was in a rage. James Miller claimed that he cursed and abused Worrell again, expecting to be killed himself, but Christopher Worrell said nothing and then Vicky's body was taken to Truro. So they picked up then on the 9th of February 1977, picked up Connie Jordan's. Connie became frightened when they drove in the wrong direction. So James Miller stopped at Wingfield and Christopher Worrell forced Connie into the backseat of the car while James Miller sat and did nothing. He left the car for a while and after returning, they drove to Truro to dump Connie's body.
So obviously hold on. It's hold bullshit on. Hold that on. He was
hold
just
on.
Like...
Hold on.
What?
One more.
Oh, no.
So Deborah Lamb was hitchhiking on West Terrace when she was picked up by James Miller and Christopher Worrell. Oh, okay. They drove to Port Gawler, which is where James Miller went for one of his famous walks. And when he returned to the car, Deborah was absent and Christopher Worrell was seen pushing sand into a hole with his foot. And it was later found out that Deborah Lamb was actually buried alive.
Oh, no. That got a lot worse. That got a lot worse.
So, yeah.
Obviously, this guy wasn't actually just conveniently taking walks while any of this was going on, right? Uh-huh. Like, he had to have been there witnessing it and or assisting.
Yep.
That's such like, oh, yeah, I was there, but I didn't do anything, officer, really. I was terrified for my life. But he fully just, was, like
pushing everything onto,
yeah. Yeah, to the dead guy.
So James Miller remained adamant that he had nothing to do with the murders.
No.
And, you know, he was like, I don't know anything. I'm not saying anything. And then when he was brought down to the cells, he said to the officers, because at this point they'd only found, I think, four of the bodies. And he's like, I'll show you where the other bodies are. So then this was now solid evidence that they could link and charge James Miller with the murders at Truro. So James Miller was driven under police escort back to Truro, 5 kilometres past Swamp Road. On the left-hand side, about 1.5 kilometres up, James Miller got the police to turn into an old disused farmhouse and pointed in the direction of the remains. With it being dark and the terrain being as it was obvious that James Miller was extremely familiar with his surroundings. Detectives then established the crime scene and Miller was driven back to Adelaide. James Miller then took the police to an isolated beach at Port Gawler where they found the remains of Deborah Lamb. It was just one of the detectives in the Crime Investigation Australia episode was talking like the beach is like a series of tracks and you can get really easily lost. It's quite a labyrinth. And he was like, if I went back there today, like I would easily just get as lost as we were that first time. Like it's such a weird area. So when they began the thorough search, a search of the beach, and then James Miller then led police to an area in Wingfield where they went to like a, it's called the Dean Rifle Range. So it's obviously somewhere where you go and practice shooting.
Shoot guns.
And showed them where they had disposed of the remains of 15-year-old Tanya Kenny. So when they found the remains of Deborah Lamb, most of the remains were actually still intact of Deborah's and her clothing was still intact as well. And they were able to sort of partially identify her because of a locket with 2 small children that was found on her remains. It was almost dawn that day when James Miller was formally charged with 7 counts of murder and he pled not guilty because that makes sense.
Yeah, sure. Whatever, buddy.
Okay. So at James Miller's trial, he revealed a terrifying story that James Miller, like him and Christopher Worrell, would cruise around the cities every night in his car and they would look for women that Christopher Worrell could have sex with. Worrell was described as like 23, he was charismatic and good looking and he had no troubles like picking up girls for local, picking up girls in the local area for casual sex. Miller would then drive Worrell and these girls to a secluded place where Christopher Worrell would have sex with them, often after tying them up, where James Miller would apparently wait outside and then Miller would drive them back into town and drop them off. He described how the pickups became more and more terrifying. First, Worrell started occasionally raping women who refused on his advances, and then that's when it escalated to murder. James Miller was unaware that the murder would occur. Idiot.
Whatever.
He stated that it only happened sometimes and not others. It appeared that as the violence increased, that James Miller became increasingly more terrified of Christopher Worrell. Miller maintained, they can give me life for knowing about the murders and not reporting them, but they charged me with murder. It's a load of bullshit. Verbatim. Following the trial, right. One of the jurors hired a lawyer to petition the Attorney General for a retrial. South Australian Chief Justice Len King agreed that Miller should be granted another hearing on the grounds that the judge at his trial, Mr. Justice Matheson, had instructed the jury to find Miller guilty of murder. However, the Attorney General, Christopher Sumner, refused to grant a retrial. Legally, Miller argued that he never engaged in any of the murders directly, nor did he explicitly agree prior to going out cruising for women that he would support Worrell in the murders. Nevertheless, he was found guilty of murder because he was found to be part of a joint criminal enterprise. He was present at the crime scenes, assisted in disposing of the bodies, and this created a subsequent This created subsequent legal difficulties over the definition of a joint criminal enterprise, but these have largely been resolved on the basis that this was a special and a particularly horrifying case.
But he also, like, facilitated the murders happening in the first place because he was the one driving them
exactly,
around.
And he didn't stop.
Like,
and that's
he
what
knew
we talked,
what was happening.
That's what we talked about in the Brisbane lesbian vampire killer case. Like, yeah. Even though those girls didn't participate in the murder, that they didn't actively try and stop.
They didn't try and stop it. They assisted in it occurring, yeah. Even if they didn't, you know, actually do anything themselves. I do think that. I mean, I believe that he was lying and he probably had more to do with it than he let on. Mm. But even taking all that aside, he was still an accomplice.
So on the 12th of March 1980, James Miller was found of 6 counts of murder, but not of the murder of the first victim, Veronica Knight. For his part in each of the murders, he was given 6 life sentences, with the parole period coming up in 2014. He spent 28 years in Yatala Labour Prison before dying of cancer in 2008. Nikki Lamb, the daughter of victim Deborah Lamb, said she was advised within minutes of Miller's death at around 10 p.m. and called his death a massive release. She said, "There will never be an end because I don't have my mother, but it is an end to a dark chapter and the beginning of a new one." He maintained up until his death that he only helped bury the bodies, and all of his recollections pointed at Worrell. He wrote a book, which I think is the most yuck thing I've ever heard in my entire life, and is so disrespectful to all of the victims and all of their families. In his book, he described himself with such like physical prowess that he could like take down any bully. And it's like, well, if you're going to brag about that shit, obviously you had more to do with these murders.
But he said that he tried to pull Worrell off one girl but couldn't. So obviously he wasn't that
obviously
strong.
Obviously you weren't that strong, mate. But in the end, 7 girls were brutally taken and murdered. And they had families that cared about them. And as far as I'm aware, no one gives a shit about James Miller. So
no, nobody ever will. Here's something that makes me furious from this case, apart from everything. You said that sometimes they would pick up girls and murder them and sometimes they wouldn't. If the police, or if there had been more publicity about the girls who had gone missing,
some
of those girls who were picked up by James and, you know, Worrell, they would be able to recognize who they were.
Exactly.
Or they would be able to be like, wait a second, I was picked up by 2 guys and they tied me up and it was really similar to this case of this girl that went missing. I should go to the police. You know, if there was any kind of publicity or anything like that, this probably could have been solved a lot quicker.
Yeah, definitely.
And Worrell could have faced some justice because, you know, he got off scot-fucking-free because he died.
So, yeah, horrific. Absolutely horrific.
That's heinous. I'm worse off for knowing about this crime.
Yeah. And at the end of the Crime Investigation Australia, one of the detectives was like, if you want to understand, like, this case, he's like, drive from Adelaide to Truro and you will understand why Christopher Worrell and James, like, this was, like, fun for them. This was game for them. Like, it is a long way to drive out to Truro. They knew what they were doing.
Yeah.
Like, they weren't.
It was part of it.
Yeah. They were not fucking around. And he's like, you think that, cooked. Absolutely cooked.
Good episode. Same, we need to shout out to Heath.
Heath, thank you so much.
Shout out to Heath.
For suggesting Truro. I am the worst off for knowing it, but I'm glad that we could tell the stories of those poor girls. I want to say their names again because they are more important than James Miller and Christopher Worrell. And I don't like how many times I said the names James Miller and Christopher Worrell. So
makes you feel better. I couldn't remember what Christopher Worrell's name was that whole time.
So Deborah Lamb, who was age 20 and disappeared on the 12th of February, 1977. Connie Jordan, who was 16, who disappeared on the 9th of February, 1977. Vicky Howell, who was 26 and disappeared on the 7th of February, 1977. Sylvia Pittman, who was age 16, who disappeared on the 6th of February, 1977. Juliet Makeda, who was 16, who disappeared on the 21st of January, 1977. Tanya Kenny, who was 15, who disappeared on the 7th of January, 1977. And Veronica Knight, who was 18, who disappeared on the 23rd of December, 1976.
That's heartbreaking.
Yeah.
Their families would still be alive. They would still miss them.
Exactly. They were missed. They were loved. They had lives and they were important. And I hope in whatever realm that they are, that they knew that people were looking for them and people cared about them.
Mm-hmm. And I hope that we learn, you know, historically from cases like this, that any person that goes missing needs to be treated. It needs to be treated as worst case scenario from the first minute, because, you know, the consequences, if it turns out they were just hitchhiking somewhere, you know, the consequences of looking for them are a lot worse.
Yeah. I also just want to bring up, because we haven't talked about it, and this is coming out a couple of weeks after it happened, but we should also mm-hmm. talk about just a little bit to finish off about the murder of Courtney Heron in Melbourne.
Mm-hmm.
Once again, absolutely furious that,
mm-hmm.
I don't know, I don't want to get too upset about this, but is so tragic that this keeps on happening. And then stemming from that, the data sheet that was released where this person has detailed like step by step of different locations in Melbourne for you to like find a target.
To find women
and to like interact, well, not to interact with them, but to, you know,
to hit on women basically. To do like, it's like a pickup artist thing.
Yeah. Absolutely abhorrent. And the murder of Courtney mm-hmm. Heron is completely disturbing. And I'm so happy in the response to this that the police were like, okay, this isn't...
It's about men's behavior.
Yeah, this isn't a woman's issue anymore. This is about men's issue because she was brutally murdered. And it didn't matter mm-hmm. her living situations. It didn't matter her past. This girl's life was taken away by some mm-hmm. psycho who I'm not even going to name, because guess what? I don't even know it, because her name is more important.
Mm-hmm.
You are allowed...
I think the...
No, you go.
Sorry, you go. You go back.
All I was going to say is that to all my lady loves out there, if you were feeling scared and if you were feeling delicate about these situations, you were totally within your justification to, because every time I get off public transport, every time I walk out the door at night, every time I leave work, I feel just as terrified as you do. So you are well within your rights to feel scared. And I want all of the men in my life to stand up and to call out this bullshit, because I'm so sick of it. I'm so sick of this complacency, because mm-hmm. women mm-hmm. keep on dying and it's just shit.
It's not on. No. I think that the response from the community has been really, and I mean by the community, I mean like the Australian public, has been really positive about Courtney's death, because, you know, she was sleeping rough. She did have a past, but apart from one like Daily Mail or Daily Telegraph article or whatever, everybody's been really, really respectful about her.
Yeah.
She's had family, she had friends that still cared about her. And nobody has kind of treated her as less than she was, which was a human being. Yeah. So I think that is a big change. That is a difference that we can see from, you know, 1977 and a lot of the other cases we've covered where, you know, certainly blame was put on victims or they were never spoken about or things like that. We have changed.
Yeah.
We're never going to be able to stop crimes from happening entirely, but we can change our response to them. And I think Courtney's death is an example of a positive public response.
Definitely.
And hopefully we don't have to mention any more names this year.
No, thank you. Because that's 20 men. That's 20 women since the start of the year.
Yeah, 20 women this year.
That have been murdered. Fucked.
So that's not good.
Okay, well, there was our first episode of the South Australian season.
Yay! Starting off with a bang,
obviously. You can follow us on Instagram at Murder in the Land of Oz. You can find us on Facebook at Murder in the Land of Oz. You can send us an email at murderintheLandOfOz@gmail.com and send us suggestions of cases, because we've got South Australia and then what? Western Australia.
Very excited.
We are coming up on our 1-year anniversary of Mitlu, which is so exciting.
We'll be past it.
By the time this comes out. Happy 1-year anniversary, Ellen. I love you so much.
Happy 1-year, babe.
And we all happy love you. Make sure you head to TeePublic to get some rad t-shirts. The best t-shirt, I think, is from a Patreon episode. So you should all get on Patreon, because apparently we're really funny over there. The quote is, "Where can I get me one of them Jim Jones communist monkeys?" And Ellen, that was you that said that.
Was it? I have no recollection whatsoever.
It was you. I listened to the episode.
Okay, good. Oh, God, I'm so funny. I wish I could remember any of the jokes I make.
Alrighty. Well, thank you so much for listening, guys. We'll see you in a fortnight.
So, what should I listen to now?
We are Castology. This is our podcast about podcasts. We are your castologists, Patrick Shearer,
Liz Best,
and Zainty Weber.
Each week, we'll bring you three of the best and sometimes not so best podcasts around. We'll also do the hard work and trawl the RSS feeds to find the newest podcast that should be on your radar.
And then next week, we come back and tell you what we thought of the recommendations and bring three new sparkling podcasts to check out.
Now, will we always agree with each other's picks?
Probably not. But hey, you're clever. You know that's how reviews work.
We're available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or any podcatcher of your choice.
That's Not Kind of Productions podcast.